L. Gates LLP versus Quantum Materials. You all want to make your announcements, please?
George Kreider, representing the appellant, K&L Gates.
Morning, Mr. Kreider. Good morning, sir. As each of you knows, you get 20 minutes each side to argue. Understand that you've gotten with a clerk and set aside your time. Understand that y'all may have multiple acts going within your 20 minutes, and so the light will come on at 3 for you. As you know, when the yellow light comes on, generally you have 2 minutes. You guys will have 3 this time. Any other period we're within, when the yellow light comes on, that means you have 2 minutes. When the red light comes on, that means you're out of time. We have an audio recording going, and so you'll be able to go on within 24 hours and look on the court's website if you want to hear yourself back in your arguments and go through them. And then by way of housekeeping, if anyone has a cell phone, pager, or other device, now would be a good time to turn that off. So with that, we'll go ahead and hear from you, Mr. Kreider.
May it please the court. The Texas Supreme Court's Youngkin versus Hines decision requires the decision below here to be reversed and rendered because Quantum's, the TCPA applies here because Quantum's complaints and all of its alleged damages are based on, related to, or in response to statements K&L Gates made or pleadings it filed in judicial proceedings. And Youngkin at page 680 says the TCPA will apply under those circumstances. And because we filed our motion to dismiss, which is part of the record, it was Quantum's burden to come forward with evidence on a prima facie case of each element of their claim, but they failed to submit any evidence before the hearing, none. Instead, they waited 7 days until after the hearing, and importantly, the trial court struck the incompetent affidavit, paragraphs 13 and 14, which were the only evidence of causation or damages that Quantum even attempted to make. And without evidence of causation or damages, which are essential elements of every one of their claims, this court must reverse and render. They cannot meet their burden.
Can I ask you, before, notwithstanding the quotes made by the trial court that you guys cited in your brief, do we know for sure whether his decision was based upon a determination that TCPA didn't apply or a determination that the prima facie case hadn't been made?
The trial court did not make any finding other than motion denied, but this court, looking de novo, can see that there is, for one thing, no evidence of causation or damages, no matter what. They failed to cross-appeal that point. And
even if the affidavit were sufficiently in evidence?
Even if the affidavit were sufficiently in evidence, and even if they could overcome the other evidentiary objections, they did not respond to any of those objections, either in the trial court or before this court. And those objections were substantial, in part because they weren't based on personal knowledge. There was hearsay, unsupported legal conclusions, best evidence rule was violated, and there were conclusory opinions by a non-attorney expert. And that's another point that is key in a case like this where they allege that a lawyer committed malpractice, DTPA violations, and alleged breach of fiduciary duty. They had to have competent expert opinions to support their claims. Again, they had none of that.
Can damages be presumed in a legal malpractice suit?
Can
damages be presumed in a legal malpractice?
No, they have to, again, you have to prove that. And here, if you look at the issue, Your Honor, of damages in this case, importantly, it shows how this case comes within the TCPA. The only damages they seek arise from the underlying case. What they don't plead any other damages. The damages are based solely on a recovery of more than $100,000 reflecting their cost in defending against the underlying case. So the damages they seek, they've pled them, but they relate solely to the underlying lawsuit. And therefore, it shows that, based on Youngkin, that the damages are based on, related to, or in response to K&L Gates' statements and documents in that underlying proceeding. So regardless of whether they stated any kind of claim for damages, they're all based upon the underlying case. And importantly, the TCPA has no exception for legal malpractice claims. The TCPA applies to litigants. It doesn't say anything about clients, and it's irrelevant if K&L Gates once was Quantum's attorney. And importantly, in the underlying lawsuit, Quantum was represented by Mr. Kretzer and Mr. Menz. K&L Gates was not representing Quantum. So when you look at the underlying case, which is what forms the basis of their case, you can see that, one, K&L Gates did not represent Quantum in that case, and two, everything they complain about came from the underlying case. And if you look at the petition, and bear in mind, of course, they are confined to the petition, not arguments they make in their brief on appeal, which you'll note are unsupported by almost any record site. Their petition is based on conduct that is clearly protected under the TCPA. They complain that K&L Gates made statements and filed documents. They say that they filed the petition and intervention. They filed the opposition to a request for temporary injunction. They appeared at a hearing and made statements. They allegedly refused to withdraw. They demanded depositions in a hearing. They allegedly forced Quantum to file a motion to disqualify, and K&L Gates filed a response. Every single one of the things about which they complain was in the underlying lawsuit. Now, they make some argument about, well, there could have been some documents once upon a time that K&L Gates drafted. The only evidence in this court, before this court in the record, is that those loan documents were prepared by other lawyers. And that is part of the supplemental record, which was filed in the case. And it shows, with publicly filed documents, that the loan transaction that was in part at issue in the underlying lawsuit, Quantum was represented by a law firm called Morse & Morse. The lenders were represented by a law firm called Legal Compliance. And the documents that were at issue in the underlying lawsuit, they're all part of the record as part of our motion to dismiss. Those documents that were at issue in the underlying lawsuit were prepared by these other lawyers, not by K&L Gates. But the court doesn't even have to worry about that. If you look at the conduct here, they're complaining solely about the petition and intervention, the opposition, and the positions that K&L Gates took in that litigation. And again, the damages they seek are, quote, monetary damages of at least $100,000 for defense against the claim. That's the clerk's record at 14. And all costs due to the intervention. That's the clerk's record at page 13. So you can see that their claims are based upon, related to, pertaining to protected activity, and accordingly, the trial court should have dismissed. The recent case that we provided to the court with notice of supplemental authority, the San Antonio Court of Appeals case in Brown-Sims, says, confirms there is no exception to the TCPA for legal malpractice claims. And in that case, it was a claim by a client against the current attorney for legal services directly at issue. Here, they're not making such a claim. So there is no exception for legal malpractice claims. Now,
can you remind me, when did Youngkin come out?
Youngkin was... let's see.
I'll have it right here. Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry, Your Honor. It was April 27, 2018.
Okay.
I apologize for going over there. One point, Chief Justice Rose, you asked about the trial court, you know, really what the trial court considered. We think it would be an abuse of discretion for the trial court to allow late filed evidence. The remedies code under the TCPA, section 27004A, says a hearing on a motion must be set. 27006A says, in determining whether a legal action should be dismissed, the court shall consider the pleadings and supporting and opposing affidavits. There's no provision in Texas law to let you have a hearing and then after the fact come in and produce evidence. And even the more recent amendments to the TCPA, which are not in effect for this case, confirm that all evidence has to have been filed before the hearing.
You basically put it on a summary judgment standard.
Basically a summary judgment standard. And otherwise, a litigant such as K&L Gates would be deprived of your opportunity to test the evidence and to complain about it. And the TCPA has deadlines and the requirement that there be evidence supporting each element of each claim for a reason. And the trial court respectfully abused its discretion to the extent that it considered the Lindbergh affidavit. But if the court looks at that affidavit...
Can I interrupt you real quick? Do you have any authority for that position, that the Lindbergh affidavit was untimely?
I think under the plain what I would say is the plain reading of the TCPA, you have to have a hearing at which the trial court will consider evidence. I don't have a case that says that, but this would be just like any other summary judgment or other hearing. You can't come in after the fact and admit evidence. It's not as if the court said, I'm continuing the hearing. And in the Brown-Sims case, which we cited, the San Antonio Court of Appeals took a look at whether the trial court there had the discretion to allow two expert affidavits to be submitted one day before the hearing. And San Antonio Court of Appeals and Brown-Sims said they had that discretion before the hearing. They noted another case in there called Mission Wrecker, where the trial court refused to allow evidence to be submitted 15 minutes before the hearing. And the San Antonio Court of Appeals said that the trial court properly exercised its discretion there. There is no case that we have seen that would allow evidence to be submitted after the fact.
But as I understand your argument, Mr. Kreider, even if that evidence was within the trial court's discretion to consider, you guys still win.
We still win. If you look at all the other evidentiary objections, we win. If you look at the fact that causation and damages, paragraphs 13 and 14 of the Lindbergh affidavit were stricken, Quantum failed to cross appeal on that point. They have no evidence of causation or damages. And that is an essential element of every claim. And as we pointed out, they don't have any expert testimony, unlike in Brown-Sims. And in Brown-Sims, what happened there was the trial court allowed the litigants to have discovery before the hearing. So they at least had the opportunity to understand who these purported experts might be. But the expert affidavits were submitted at least one day before the hearing, and there was evidence before the trial court and before the appellate court de novo that supported the elements of duty, breach, causation, damages, breach of the standard of care. All of those things are essential elements in legal malpractice claims, breach fiduciary duty claims, and DTPA claims based on legal services. There is none of that evidence. They have none of it. And so even if the court were to consider portions of the Lindbergh affidavit, nonetheless, they still fail in their case. They still have not produced evidence of their to support each and every claim. Separately, we also believe that attorney immunity would bar their claims. Youngkin involved both the application of the TCPA and the application of the attorney immunity doctrine. The attorney immunity doctrine is determined by the court as a matter of law. And what the court said in Youngkin at page 683 is that the only facts required to support an attorney immunity defense are the type of conduct at issue and the existence of an attorney-client relationship. Once those facts are established, the court decides, quote, the legal question of whether the conduct was within the scope of the representation. Well, what they're complaining about is exactly what lawyers do. They're complaining that K&L Gates filed a petition in intervention, came to a hearing, sought discovery, sought depositions. That is what lawyers do, and none of that is foreign to the conduct of an attorney. So under Youngkin, the TCPA certainly applies, and under Youngkin, we believe that that the attorney immunity defense also has been established. And the court in Youngkin went on to say it doesn't matter the label that you put on the attorney's conduct. You can call it wrongful, you can call it fraudulent, you can call it outrageous. It doesn't matter the conduct. It focuses solely on the kind of conduct rather than the alleged wrongfulness of the conduct. That's what the Supreme Court said in Yonkin, 546 Southwest 3rd at 681. So you have to look beyond any characterizations that Quantum may have about what K&L Gates allegedly did and see that they were acting as attorneys in a legal proceeding. They're complaining about what they did, what they wrote, what they filed, and therefore it is both covered by the TCPA and it also is within the scope of attorney immunity.
Because to the extent that there's outrage about that, I didn't see any sort of movement in the legislature to specifically exempt attorney-client. I'm thinking back to our Rosera case where we had the attorney misconduct allegation that
right.
we found to be within the TCPA, and they came and amended the TCPA to specifically exempt that. Did we have any sort of movement like that with regard to attorney-client?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. And again, I would look at the TCPA as applying to litigants, not to clients. It's not talking about clients at all. And here, it comes squarely within the scope. If I may reserve my remaining 5 minutes.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Kreider.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Morning, sir.
Our position is that the TCPA does not apply in this case, and that is because the motion to dismiss section of the TCPA, 27.003, is impacted with a positively elegant simplicity. Subsection A reads, if a legal action is based on, relates to, or is in response to a party's exercise of the right of free speech, right of petition or association, that party may file a motion to dismiss the legal action. We would argue the possessive phrasing of that term party says that it's the party's right that is at issue here. And in Yonkin, the Texas Supreme Court was very clear, direct quote at the end of subsection A of that opinion, importantly, comma, we do not opine on whether an attorney has a constitutional right to petition that encompasses speaking on behalf of a client. Our argument would be we had no compunction in when these lenders intervened in the injunction suit in San Marcos. We didn't move to strike their intervention. They came along ultimately with a different law firm, litigated it, and then we were successful, Mr. Menz and I, on appeal. The problem is not that those lenders exercised and came into court and did the various things that Mr. Kreider described. The problem is that KLA's, not any communicative act, but their act of appearing for two clients simultaneously, the lenders over here, at the same time they were still representing, still had outstanding invoices, still had possession of Quantum's files. That is the core issue, and that's why the TCPA quite simply is not implicated. So we would argue that the court could stop at that level.
So you're arguing that under 27.03 they're not a party?
No, they were not. Yeah, no, they're certainly a party in this case. Okay, I don't dispute that. The issue.
And isn't that what that's referring to, is a party in the case where the TCPA is
sure. Anyone who's going to file a motion to dismiss would necessarily be a party in this case. I don't think that's how the TCPA is describing it here, though. Here what we're looking at is all the things Mr. Kreider described at length in his time, all of the actions that his firm took when they represented these two lenders who came along and intervened in that injunction suit that they then ultimately prosecuted with new counsel after K&L Gates substituted in Mr. Cleveland's firm, Cleveland Terrazas. So we would argue that when they use the word party, it's not that they're not a party in this case. Of course, they are. We sued them. It's what constitutional right of association, First Amendment right, and so forth is implicated. And there simply is, when they come along and make those assertions, as filings in a court for a party, it's that underlying party. In that case, those two lenders that they chose to represent, they were the ones, if anything, who had the constitutional right. There's not a derivative or third-party ability to come along and exercise those rights in the court. That's important because it's part and parcel with the cases that they cite, Yonkin and some of the predecessor cases, where it's not, you know, an attorney immunity. These were non-clients who came along and tried to sue these lawyers for various things they did in the court. And as much as my friends at Vincent Elkins may want to wish that were so, there is no way, I do not believe, they can persuade this court that Quantum was in any sense a non-client, which means a never client. Not only were they arguably a current client under their own terms of their own engagement letter, they had never moved to withdraw, sent an invoice marked final, they didn't send the file to substantially later after we repeatedly asked them, they had possessions, they had sat in on the board meetings of Quantum, done all of this work for Quantum. They were necessarily clients.
Doesn't all that go to the prima facie case, though?
Well,
I mean, isn't that what you could or should have proven in the hearing with these affidavits?
Well, let me move that. Even if we were not to prevail and convince you that the slap doesn't apply, then we would argue that turning to the section on 27.005, that what K&L Gates is trying to do here is fundamentally, I would use the word transmogrify that section of the TCPA to something that it does not exist to. The exact words, I'm reading from subsection C.
Transmogrifying the TCPA sounds like a great idea to us. I'm not sure exactly what transmogrify means.
Sure.
But
there's no doubt the legislature has done transmogrifying.
If that somehow cuts down on the number of interlocutory TCPA appeals we see, then I'm all for transmogrification.
And there's no doubt, and I'm certainly not an expert in TCPA, in this last session, the bill that Governor Abbott signed effective as of September 1, it did remove that term relates to, which it went on down and made any number of other changes to the TCPA prospectively. And I understand it's created a large amount of interlocutory courts across the state have had to deal with. But regardless, and for whatever the current for going forward form of the TCPA may be, at section 20, when it comes to the trial court at 27.005 regarding ruling, subsection C says, quote, establishes by clear and specific evidence a prima facie case. As far as I can tell, what Mr. Kreider wants to do is transform this section into a functional equivalent of a no evidence summary judgment before any discovery is had, buttressed by a requirement that one have expert reports at the outset like one would in a medical malpractice case. When the legislature has done that, it has been very specific that it's had all those heightened requirements. In Youngkin alone, there was not a sworn affidavit. They even said that it might have been the better practice, but there what we're looking for is, you know, whether or not the contours of what Mr. Youngkin did in that case, that he spread the Rule 11 agreement on behalf of his clients allowed in the court. Here, the core, the nucleus of facts, I think, is very clear. In other words, what K&L Gates did was simultaneously represent both clients, the lenders, and my client, Quantum, at the same time. They were representing both. If that is taken, and that can be taken alone not only by the force of the affidavits, but it is also looks at the pleadings. I'm looking at section 27.006. It says, quote, the court shall consider the pleadings and supporting or opposing affidavits. Maybe certainly a pleading is not evidence. So we would argue that when the statute says clear and specific evidence, that doesn't mean evidence admissible at a trial. That just means a pleading, unless it has an admission against interest, is not trial admissible evidence. That's why we would argue what the Lindberg affidavit does, or how it serves, is very similar to a corporate rep deposition. We run into this all the time in my practice. That's how you get the discovery as to the corporation. You take that person's deposition. That doesn't mean that everything the corporate representative says will necessarily be admissible at trial. The statute also talks about the quote-unquote essential of the prima facie case. In a no-evidence summary judgment, you have to designate which elements you think the evidence is insufficient, and then you can go about having that summary judgment battle. What Mr. Kreider's trying to do is to say when the statute says essential elements, it basically means no evidence as to every single element that is there. We don't think that the statute functions in that way, nor does Youngkin, in any part of the Youngkin opinion, get them to where they would need to go in order to hoist us on the petard of not having adduced sufficient evidence. I would argue the transcript of the hearing in January of this year, when Mr. Kreider and Mr. Menz and I were there, when the judge said that he would give up to 7 days to take additional affidavits, Mr. Kreider, I'm direct quoting here, said, yeah, and sure. I would argue they've waived any argument that we, you know, impermissibly sprung this affidavit on them. The judge said that he was going to accept affidavits, and at the time they had no problem with it. Nothing says that a hearing has to be held and completed on that one specific day. My God, when you subpoena a witness, the subpoena says day to day until the evidence is concluded. There's simply no issue with timing here. So we would argue, well, we didn't have to submit any affidavit. We could have simply rested on the force of the pleading. We did submit the affidavit. The review here is de novo. I think I heard Mr. Kreider say abuse of discretion. Review in this court here is de novo, so you can affirm on any basis in the record. Even we would submit, looking at the Lindbergh affidavit, even if one were to put aside those paragraphs 13 and 14 that the district court struck, and I would agree with the Chief Justice, the question you asked Mr. Kreider at the beginning, the judge didn't explain what basis he, you know, rested his ruling that successfully defeated the slap motion. But in paragraphs 9, in paragraphs 12, it talks extensively about debt financing. It also talks about his losses to stock and so forth. But there's no doubt that K&L Gates advised Quantum in the months, the period of time from starting in 2016 when they signed that engagement letter with the CEO, Mr. Squires, that they gave them corporate advice on debt financing and what these two lenders ultimately intervened on and what they've since spawned litigation all over the country. And we've had cases in Florida and Kansas, other litigation elsewhere they've had to deal with at great expense was about, they claimed, hyper-technical defaults on the debt financing. Nor are we talking here about parties, just apropos of nothing, but lenders that have not been paid. These folks have been paid in full at huge returns. What they really want is to convert their debt into an equity stake. Largely, I think it's a fair inference, and we would know if we were able to go forward with discovery, if K&L Gates was front-ran some of that information so that these lenders showed up and took what would otherwise be considered a very illogical, very litigation-expensive position in the litigation. But in no sense, K&L Gates, having done all this work for Quantum over a period of time and currently claiming they're owed over $1 million in legal fees, in no sense, I think I put in the brief with a straight face, and I wasn't trying to be facetious, I don't know how they can say with a straight face that we are non-clients. Maybe in their own mind we were former clients, but even if so, they did not do the things under their own contract, under their own engagement letter that they would have to do.
What was the nature? Wasn't there a conflict waiver somewhere? Did I see a reference to that?
They do have what they purport to be a very broad prospective conflict waiver. I don't know that you can have a waiver of any and all conflict that might come up ever in the future. That was some boilerplate language that they put in there. So I guess I would challenge the ethics of having a broad prospective conflict waiver that applies to any circumstance they might subsequently move to apply it to. I don't know that, and I know Texas is much more generous than other states when it comes to accepting conflicts and waivers. I don't think any state in the union, the ethics rules allow a law firm to represent both sides simultaneously. I think that would be a bridge too far. In the same way, a criminal defense lawyer can't represent multiple defendants in the same criminal case. It doesn't matter if they consent to it or not. The government's going to file a motion to disqualify, which the judge is surely going to grant. I don't think any state ethic rules, malpractice rule, so forth, those doctrines allow simultaneous representations of both sides of a case. Now, the Brown-Sims case, I would argue, cuts in our favor. And I know it's a recent case. It is, of course, a San Antonio case from about a month ago. The San Antonio case volunteered the point that we made in the brief that there had not been before that Brown and Sims case, a case redressing whether or not Foursquare attorney malpractice came within the ambit of the TCPA or if it didn't. Of course, I think it's a somewhat, when they filed a notice of supplemental authority and I read the case, I thought it was a somewhat unusual case for them to cite in that ultimately the denial of the motion to dismiss under the slap was affirmed. So, of course, I mean, we'll take a win which way that it wants to be conceptualized. But even on that narrow portion of whether or not attorney malpractice comes within the ambit of the slap, I would respectfully submit that the San Antonio court got that wrong and that this court should write an opinion expressing that logical difference. The reason being, not wrong because of, you know, we just simply don't like it, but because I don't think it follows the text and the structure of the form of the TCPA. One of the catalytic events on which the San Antonio Court of Appeals rested its holding was that attorney malpractice is not listed exception in the slap statute. Well, there's no doubt it's not listed. There's certain things that are listed there. I understand the recent amendments expanded the list of things that are not going to be under that exceptions. For example, a motion for a post-judgment collection, receiverships, those are going to be new listed exceptions. But it's not the case that everything in the world is covered by SLAPP unless it falls under that narrow exception. In that attorney malpractice case, where Brown and Sims apparently, as they pleaded, did not include a specific affirmative defense, didn't make a special appearance, the judgment calls on what affirmative defenses are to be included in such a petition, what claims are to be made, those are necessarily the purview of the client. The plaintiff sits down with the plaintiff's lawyer and decides how to structure the lawsuit. I think that is a structurally important is a criminal case, whether or not a criminal defendant has the absolute right to decide whether or not to take the stand, whether or not he would take a plea or not. He's necessarily exercising his rights or his or her company's rights to public participation. Those are not the lawyer's rights that are being implicated there. And the distinction that the lawyers that the Spagnoletti firm tried to draw was, oh, well, here we're talking about things that were not said. We did not include this affirmative defense, did not file this special appearance. The San Antonio court said, no, whether or not you're saying something or not saying it in that document that you're filing, it's still a communication. We would argue that somewhat misses the mark, because what happened there was it was still the client's right implication of the public participation what was at issue. We're not arguing it's an exception. We're arguing that the teeth of the TCPA, the way it's structured under the various statutes as I've described them, simply don't – the reach exceeds the grasp of where K&L Gates wants this to go. Another distinction, though, between all the cases they cite, with Brown and Sims as well as the others they cite in their brief, is that they're necessarily talking about litigation specific. They came to court, they filed the motion, they did these things. There's no doubt that K&L Gates, in the 2.5 years they represented Quantum, they were not doing litigation type work. Instead, what they were doing was sitting in on board meetings, providing corporate advice, things of the sort. So the situation here is even further removed than the ones that you saw at issue that compelled the reversals, or at least the holdings, and all of the other cases that that they cite. So we think that for any number of reasons that it should be, we simply fall farther afield than where they would need to go in order to reach a finding that the TCPA applied. I know it is de novo review, but I don't think it should be glossed over that the trial judge, and I quoted this twice in my brief and bolded it, he said at the end of the lengthy hearing, I simply don't believe that the legislature intended to insulate all attorney malpractice. And one of the reasons I think we can divine that from the legislative intent is that here we were looking at yeoman litigants who were whistleblowers who were being shut down by potentially expensive and vexatious litigation from Lance Armstrong or deep-pocketed people of the type. The situation we have here is where you would have, in fact, the opposite, large corporate entities, but law firms, as it were, who have the possession of their client files, who would be able to pretermit the client's ability to sue them for legal malpractice by falling back on, oh, whatever we did for you, we were necessarily vindicating our own constitutional rights to speak, even if we were doing it completely on your behalf. And I think that's simply far away from the intent of the statute, from any other case, even putting Brown Sims aside, has gone. And there's a reason that there's not a lot of cases supporting where K&L Gates would need you to go, partly because of the public perception, the unfairness of allowing lawyers to insulate themselves from their own attorney malpractice cases. There's also no limiting principle on where K&L Gates would want this to end up. In other words, if we accept that a lawyer, even a litigation counsel, going into court, filing things in the court, is simultaneously exercising their own First Amendment privilege, then there could be no attorney malpractice case where some lawyer will not be able to come along and make that argument and try to shut this down on the TCPA. The TCPA simply does not have, under its own terms, these high evidentiary hurdles, like a no-evidence summary judgment, that they want this court to go without the benefit of any discovery. I don't think even Mr. Kreider, all zealousness for his client, would dispute the simple reality from the well-pleaded complaint that his client, K&L Gates, simultaneously represented two people on the same side, the lenders and Quantum.
So how do you square your thoughts on the San Antonio case with Youngkin and the Supreme Court's holding there?
Sure. Youngkin said that the better practice might be to have affidavits. I can accept Mr. Kreider's characterization. There was an extensive affidavit practice. Practice might not be the right word. There were these submissions of affidavits, dueling affidavits, more akin to a summary judgment was the way that the Beck-Redden firm and Spagnoletti chose to do it at issue in that case. We're also talking about a case where there was something like an underlying $40 million plaintiff's verdict that was ultimately settled for 10. So we're dealing with, you know, qualitatively larger amounts of money. I can accept that in more sophisticated cases or cases with deeper pockets, maybe that would be a practice where people would go. But when you're dealing with relatively impecunious litigants like Quantum, if they cannot afford a significant expert battle before they've ever been able to get out the gate, then the law simply does not require them to go and get such expert battle of the experts on an a priori basis. When the legislature has done that, Chief Justice Rose, it has been in cases like in the medical malpractice context, architects and engineers, where everyone knows that there's going to be this expert battle, and that expense is something that the plaintiff's lawyers build into their model going into that particular type of cases, because it was a public policy determination they want to protect those particular genres of professionals. The TCPA was not designed to be a general insulation for every professional to keep from being sued by the parties if they give render negligent performance of their professional disposition. I see my time is rapidly dwindling, but I'd like to pass to Mr. Menz because he, I think, would like to add a few of those.
Let's give Mr. Menz his full 3 minutes since you were asking him, answering a question.
Thank you, Your Honor. And first of all, the battle over evidence, you don't need, unless this court is prepared to overrule Youngkin, the Supreme Court case, which I assume it's not, it said the better practice was to have affidavits, but they're not required. And there was no sworn testimony in that, but they considered as evidence the memos and the pleadings. And the SLAPP statute suggests that you consider those things too. So,
isn't it similar to a pleaded jurisdiction type standard? I mean, that's the way I think of it a lot.
I think so, Your Honor. And but here, and in Brown is completely inapplicable because there was discovery in Brown. There's been no discovery in this case whatsoever. One of the questions was, admit or deny, and this is in the transcript, admit or deny that you are representing both parties simultaneously on the same day. We don't have an answer to that. That would be curative. That would outrage a jury and I believe every appellate panel if the truthful answer is we admit. And then after that interrogatory, if you deny that, explain the relationship, the time when you started representing them. So we don't have that discovery. This was never anticipated by the legislative body that someone could have the potential. This is a fact issue. They're now claiming because of they never sent any more bills that the representation was over. One of the things in the contract, which is talked about in the affidavit that is in front of you, is that one of the terms was that if they left and if they resigned, they had to bring the new lawyer up to T as the prior predecessor before them was brought up to T. So they have all the confidential files created by the previous law firm, all the confidential files created by them, and they're going to use those. They have a duty to use them against us if they're allowed to, because they have a duty of full disclosure to both parties. Both litigants probably should be suing Cain or Gates. They have a duty to both sides. They violated their duty to both sides. They violated the contractual rights. The affidavit is in evidence. They're asking you to overrule the standard of evidence in the Supreme Court in Youngkin. They're also asking you to change the laws, create brand new precedent that a judge can't say, bring me more evidence, I want to continue this hearing for another day, give me an affidavit. They're changing the law on that too. That I don't think you can do that without legislative authority, and certainly it's never been done. There's no cases addressing that in spite of the fact that they yielded this anyway. They waived it if they had such a right, which does not exist in law, common law, or existing law. A hearing is not necessarily defined by the oral progress. They might as well say, you guys have to render a decision today because the hearing will be over when we leave in 10 minutes. It is absurd, the lengths to which they're trying to strap this new law, and nobody ever imagined this. This is an absurd expansion of the law. The debt financing, all this case is debt financing. And K&L Gates did all the legal work for the debt financing, and now K&L Gates simultaneously saying our work was malpractice, and because of that malpractice, the debt financing suit goes forward. So they're essentially putting us in the position of having to defend their legal work, which they're going to be attacking. We're not attacking K&L Gates' legal work. We're attacking their right and duty, if they accept this employment, to give full disclosure of the information that they created for this debt information, and that's in the affidavit. He says that was one of the primary things they did. When you prepare a tax return, sometimes the office does everything, and the guy that signs it, which was Morsi because he was cheaper than K&L Gates, didn't do the pre-work on it. You don't say that the person that prepared the tax return information can be an adverse party to you in front of the Internal Revenue Service. Only the person that signed the return. In these large CPA firms, that's often what happens. They don't even see the work product. K&L Gates actually performed the work that they are suing our client, claiming that the work that they did was insufficient. That is in the pleadings. The pleadings are before you, the memos are before you, the research is before you, the affidavit is before you, and it remains before you, and it is evidence, clear evidence, under Youngkin, which does not require affidavits. If we had an infinite purse, would it be better to have affidavits? Absolutely. We don't have it. And this man is an expert, by the way. He is entitled to it. He has a master's degree in business. He's been chief financial officer for several public companies.
Mr. Mays, we're running out of time.
I thank you for your indulgence, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Next thing you know, Mr. Crider will be wanting more time.
Most of what you just heard is not only contrary to the law, it's not in the record. For example, you heard them say the Supreme Court said affidavits aren't needed for a TCPA. If you look at Youngkin at page 683, they were talking about the attorney immunity defense, not about the TCPA. So they're wrong on that point. We absolutely dispute what counsel said, that we simultaneously represented both parties in the underlying suit. That's just false. It is clear that Mr. Menz and Kretzer were representing Quantum in that case, and that K&L Gates, for only 10 days, was in that lawsuit. And Quantum got the relief they wanted. Instead of disqualification, K&L Gates withdrew.
Can we infer anything from K&L Gates withdrawing so soon?
No, only that. I mean, lawyers will do that all the time to let the clients move ahead with their particular case. So you can't infer anything at all. I mean, what you can look at here is that K&L Gates did not represent Quantum in that litigation. It had its own counsel, Quantum did. The claims are not based on K&L Gates' transactional work. They're based on what K&L Gates did in the lawsuit. They're complaining about that, and the damages are based on the lawsuit. One of the things you heard is that the argument that's been absolutely rejected by the court that the TCPA doesn't apply to lawyers. That's absurd, and that's contrary to any case. Youngkin involved an attorney, and it applied to him, even though he was acting on behalf of his clients. We cited the court to Johnson Todd versus Morgan in our initial brief at page 14 and our reply brief at page 4. We conclude the remedies provided by the TCPA extend to attorneys who are acting as agents for their clients. So their position on that is just simply unfounded. The TCPA clearly will apply here. They have no evidence to support their claims, and if you look at the petition itself, it's based upon the conduct of K&L Gates. It's not based upon some other transactional work. Now, you heard Mr. Kretzer say something about the trial court authorizing the filing of an affidavit or evidence. What the trial court said is, I'll give you all a week. I'm talking about any case law or whatever. He doesn't say you may file an affidavit. He doesn't say you may file evidence. Quantum never sought leave to file an affidavit or evidence. They never sought leave to take discovery. Chief Justice Rose, you asked about the conflict waiver. That's in the record at pages 27 and 32, but there was an advance waiver of conflicts expressly where Quantum said that K&L Gates could represent other clients in future matters adverse to them. It's a standard conflict waiver, and the provision there does say, provided that they are not substantially related. It is undisputed here, if you look at the record, that the loan documents were not prepared by K&L Gates. They were prepared by Morse & Morse. It's in our motion to dismiss. It will be in the public SEC records that were filed. We have a declaration which is part of the record at page 48. It shows that Morse & Morse represented Quantum in the loan transaction and that the lenders, whom they later sued, were represented by Legal Compliance LLC. That's in the record in the same exhibit before the court. That's the evidence that the trial court had. That's the evidence this court can review de novo. And so in sum, if you look at the petition, not the arguments that they're making, without a single cite to the record, and if you look at their brief, you won't find citations to any evidence. You won't find citations substantially to anything in the record. We have cited the court and have before the court evidence. And if you look at this, you will see that their complaints are about conduct in litigation. Their damages are based upon conduct in litigation. The fact that there may have been some other documents out there that they point to are irrelevant. And if you even look at Yonkin, in Yonkin, there was a claim that the attorney prepared a deed used to transfer property, allegedly to help his clients avoid complying with an agreement. The plaintiff also claimed that the lawyer aided the party to wrongfully assert ownership over the property. These were inconsistent with statements in court. The complaint related to what happened in court. What they're complaining about is what happened in court. And the fact that they point to some documents that somebody allegedly drafted doesn't change the fact that the damages they seek and what they're really complaining about is conduct in a judicial proceeding, which is squarely within the scope of Yonkin. So for these reasons, respectfully, we would urge the court to reverse and render the decision, both based on the TCPA and the applicability of attorney immunity. Thank you.
Thank you all. It's always good to see there are further issues to explore under the TCPA. And court will submit the case and the court will stand at recess.
Thank you.